Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. Martin Heidegger begins Being in Time by stressing the need to recover a question. That of being, which turns out to be the question of the meaning of being. Now, that sounds very, very abstract, very metaphysical, and you may be wondering what he's talking about there. What exactly is the being, and how do we formulate this question? Heidegger works at that precisely by pointing out to us that there's a good reason why this should appear puzzling, why it may not even seem like a real object of inquiry or a starting point. He tells us that, this is the very beginning line, this question has today been forgotten. And why has it been forgotten? He thinks that this has to do with an entire line of philosophical approaches that begin with the ancient Greeks, with Plato, Aristotle, come all the way down to, you know, such luminaries such as Hegel with his science of logic, which Heidegger references there, and everything in between and beyond that is involved with this particular attitude towards being that comes from, as Heidegger would say, an inadequate ontology. So he tells us that there's a dogma in place already. What is a dogma? When we talk about somebody being dogmatic, we mean that they have some sort of preconceived notion or belief that they are relying upon. Now, there's an older conception of dogma that says that it's something that you need to believe in order to make any sort of progress. And Heidegger here wants to question something that has been framed as a dogma if we're going to do philosophy, or indeed if we're going to do any sort of discipline or inquiry at all. And this has to do with being itself. So he tells us, what is this dogma? That being is the most universal and empty of concepts. He's going to go on and tell us that this resists every attempt at definition. This most universal and thus indefinable concept doesn't need any definition. Everybody uses it constantly, already understand what's meant by it. And he tells us, thus what troubled ancient philosophizing and kept it so by virtue of its obscurity has become to us in the present obvious, clear as day. And if you begin asking about being, people will say, oh, you're making a beginner's mistake. Heidegger wants to take us back beyond that, and he talks about three prejudices. He identifies three particular ways in which people are setting a stumbling block in the way of even conceiving that there could be a question of being. So, the first prejudice is that being is the most universal concept. And I highlight that term universal there because Heidegger is going to stress to us that there's more than one way of being universal. He quotes a few nice passages from Greek and Latin, you know, to on esti catholu malista panton, illud quod primo carit sum apprehensione est ens, quis intellectus includitur in omnibus, quae cumque quis apprehendit, and then summarizes these by saying an understanding of being is already contained in everything we apprehend in beings. Now, if being is a universal concept, what does that mean for us to be universal? Let's think by way of analogy to these pieces of chalk, right? Three individual pieces, is there some sort of universal that encompasses them? Yes, chalk. And, you know, we could say writing implement, or we could say hard substance, mineral, or something along those lines. And what we're doing there is we're moving from a lower level of individuality and specificity up to higher and higher levels of what we might nowadays call classes or types. But in ancient philosophy, these were called species and then genus. Now, is being a genus? Some people have treated it as if it is such. Heidegger says, no, being is not a genus. And as a matter of fact, Aristotle knew this already. So it doesn't have the kind of universality that genus does. He says, being does not delimit the highest region of beings insofar as they are conceptually articulated according to genus and species. So if we want to say that being is in fact the most universal, it's not universal in the way that we're most often considering universality. So we want to put this prejudice aside. The second prejudice that he discusses is that the concept of being is indefinable. Now think about how we define things. Now, go beyond just providing a verbal definition, or, you know, let alone some sort of tendentious, stipulative definition that happens to, you know, fit whatever you're trying to do at a particular time. Think about what it means when we really do, in fact, define something. We say what it is. We provide a verbal formula that in some respect is supposed to capture the essence of whatever the thing is. Why wouldn't we be able to define being? He says, this conclusion is drawn from its highest universality. And correctly so. If definition happens through the proximate genus and specific difference. If we define by saying first what kind of thing it is and then saying how it's different from other things. We can't do that with being, now can we? But again, we need to think, is this the only way to define things? Are we relying on a prejudice here? Then the third thing he comes to, the third prejudice, being is the most self-evident concept. Once again, we have to think about this term. What does self-evident mean? And this has a long historical set of connotations within philosophy. Something is self-evident if you don't need to explain it. If as soon as somebody runs into it, they immediately grasp it or understand what's going on with it. And he says, being is used in all knowing and predicating in every relation of beings and in every relation to oneself. And the expression is understandable without further ado. Everyone understands four examples he provides. The sky is blue. The is there is the being, right? I am happy, and similar statements. And he says, but this average comprehensibility only demonstrates the incomprehensibility. It shows that an enigma lies in any use of being, in relations, in predication, in you name it. There's a kind of enigma there. And many of the treatments of being have said, there's no question here. Being just is what it is, and that's it. We can talk about all the other things, but we can't effectively talk about being because you're already presuming it just to talk about it here. So Heidegger says, no, we actually do need to ask this question. What is the meaning of being? Is it possible for us to actually conceptualize being? Already, in asking that question, we're making an advance beyond these prejudices, beyond this dogma. He tells us that the question itself of the meaning of being must be formulated. And he says this has to be brought to a suitable transparency. So he says, well, let's think for a minute what it means to actually question. Not just ask a single question, but to question, to inquire after things. Questioning, he says, is a kind of seeking. Now, this may seem perfectly obvious to you, but think about how seeking works. You've lost your car keys. Do you just go looking everywhere for them? Or are you guided by something? Is there anything that tells you, well, maybe don't look in your car itself, right? Unless you're prone to leaving your car keys in your car, in which case something else guides you to that. So he says, every seeking takes a direction beforehand from what is sought. It's not a pure random exercise. So he says, questioning is a knowing search for beings in their thatness and whatness. And he goes on and he gives a whole bunch of examples of, you know, different types of questioning. And then he says, okay, let's come back to the point. The question to be formulated is about the meaning of being. So we have to explicate the question of being with regard to its structural moments. So he says, questioning needs prior guidance from what it seeks. In this way, we have to be getting prior guidance from being. Now, we already, as we know, this whole idea of it being self-evident, relied on the fact that we already comport ourselves in relation to being. We already are involved with being. We just don't quite know what being is at the point that we begin inquiring about it. But we can take a sort of direction from that. So he says, what is asked about in the question to be elaborated in is being. That which determines beings as beings, that in terms which of which beings have always been understood, no matter how they are discussed. Now he tells us something else important here. The being of beings is not itself a being. Let me say that one more time, because it may be a little bit difficult to wrap your head around. The being of beings, the whole plenitude of beings, is not itself a being. It's not one thing that we can point towards. So already we're getting some slight clarification about the question of being. Now, perhaps this may not have illuminated everything, but you have at least a puzzle in front of you. And if that's the case, then you do understand something, that there is indeed a question of being to ask and then pursue. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.